a link, and then you're just going to want to go there and open the notes so that you can follow along with us if you would like to do that. Okay. So again, lesson 161, the companies at work, establishing a work in progress timeline. That's what we're going to be talking about here this morning. So let's get right into the introduction here, because as always, there's a lot of material to cover and only an hour to do it. So the last three lessons have been devoted to looking at Bancroft's rules as well as the translators and their companies. The rules to be observed in translation, we covered that in lesson 158. Then we follow that up with the rules to be observed in translation part two, and we tried to look at to what extent were the rules followed. And then last Sunday we looked at the translators, their companies, and their personal libraries in lesson 160. So the last three lessons have been related now to the rules, the companies, the different things that we kind of have to cover to get set to now talk about the work in progress. In this lesson we want to use surviving primary source documents to establish a work in progress timeline for the entire project. So that's what we're going to try to do today. We're going to try to lay it out and understand how this thing went down throughout from 1604 all the way through to its publication in 1611. So let's get right into our main point then, the work in progress timeline. A few points, occasionally I'll probably stop to see if there are any questions. There's going to be a lot of dates here, stuff to follow, so we'll do the best we can here. So following Hampton Court in January 1604, it took about 5 months to draft the rules, choose and organize the translators into their various companies, and commence the work on the project. Dr. David Norton states the following regarding the matter in A Textual History of the King James Bible. By the way, that's that book, this book right here. This book is absolutely essential. This is the book that Craig gave me to read 10 years ago that changed everything for me as far as how I understood this issue. Reading this book unlocked a whole lot of things for me that I have since spent the last decade trying to trace down and understand in more detail. So his book from 2005 there, A Textual History of the King James Bible, is absolutely essential reading when it comes to this particular topic. So here's what he says. Quote, within 5 months of the Hampton Court Conference, translators had been selected, probably through a mixture of invitation and petition, both by and on behalf of individuals. So what Norton's saying there is there's probably some that are invited and probably some that asked to be on the project. But in that time period, in about 5 months, give or take, that's how long it's generally going to take to set things up. As one might expect, there was a fair amount of drama and jealousy over who was chosen to translate and who was not. Norton elaborates in footnote 11 on page 11, where he says, quote, evidence for this comes from two sources, from Thomas Bodley's letter to the keep of his library, Thomas James, on the 26th and 31st of October and 17th of November, 1604. So there's just a citation where you can look at that. It appears that James was one of the men chosen, but Bodley, this James is not King James. This James is the Thomas James mentioned in the previous line. Thomas James worked for Thomas Bodley and ran his library from all that I can gather. So it appears that James was one of the men chosen, but Bodley, anxious not to lose his services, interfered. James expostulated with his domineering master, who, appearing ignorant of James's wish to be part of the work, gave him an account of his actions. Quote, I took my journey purposely to Oxford upon it to talk with the parties by whom you were chosen to dismiss you from it. And Dr. Reynolds, upon my speeches, thought it also reason not to press you any further. Moreover, I have signified since unto you that unless of yourself were willing, no man would enforce you, offering if you were to talk with the Bishop of London, which would have been Bancroft, in that behalf. So here we have an example of a guy who's chosen, but the guy who employs him doesn't want him to go, so he goes up and interferes on his behalf to excuse him from the work. But did the guy actually want to be a part of the work, according to the evidence that we see here, right? Walker writes of jealousy over the selection of John Boyce as a translator, quote, when it pleased God to move King James to the excellent work, the translation of the Bible, when the translators were to be chosen for Cambridge, he was sent for thither by those there employed, and was a chosen one, some university men threat repining, it may be more able, yet more ambitious, to have borne a share in that service, disdaining that it should be thought they needed any help from the country, as given by Allen. So they don't want John Boyce because he's a country bumpkin. This is essentially what that means, right? So there's a lot of, you know, in the scholar, by the way, does this kind of stuff still happen today in the ivory towers of academia? This type of professional jealousy and all this sort of thing. So there is some of that going on. So as the men are being selected and chosen, and some are petitioning and some are trying to get out of it, and all this thing is happening in that first 5 months from January 1604 at Hampton Court till when it starts, there's evidence of some of these types of situations unfolding. Also on page 11, Norton cites the following letter dated the 30 June 1604 from Richard Bancroft, the chief overseer of the project, presumably to the Vice Chancellor of Cambridge, quote, "His Majesty being much acquainted with the choice of all them to be employed in the translating of the Bible, in such sort as Mr. Lively can inform you, doth greatly approve of the said choice. And for as much as His Highness is very anxious that the same, so religious a work, should admit of no delay, He has commanded me to signify unto you in His name that His pleasure is you should with all possible speed meet together in your university and begin in the same." So, what is that? That's an admonition now from Richard Bancroft, the soon-to-be Archbishop of London, for them to get on with it. All right? It's set up, the guys are chosen, so on and so forth, and notice the date on that letter. The date of that letter is the 30th of June, right? So the Hampton Court meeting happens in January 1604. It takes them about, say, 5 to 6 months, give or take, to get everybody set up. And then we have a dated letter from the Archbishop basically saying, you guys need to get on with the program here, particularly, I believe, at Cambridge here, and start the process of the translation. In a letter dated 4 September 1604, Sir Thomas Bodley reported that the translators are, quote, "hard at it in Cambridge," thereby indicating that by at least late August 1604, the work had commenced at Cambridge. So intense was the work at Cambridge that many believed it hastened the death of Edward Lively, head of the First Cambridge Company. In May 1605, regarding the early work at Oxford and Westminster, Professor Norton states the following. So before we read that, Lively dies less than a year into the project. Now, I've read all sorts of stuff about this. Some people think that the stress of him having to run a company and manage the project, he was already a fairly old guy to begin with, but the stress of this, some surmise, I don't know if it's true, there's probably no way to know, that it led to his death. Look at the quote now from Norton. Bodley's letter perhaps implies that the work at Oxford started a little more slowly, but it was evidently demanding enough by January 1605 for one of the translators, John Perrin, to resign as Regius Professor of Greek. Work at Westminster also started early, though perhaps less diligently. In November 1604, Lancelot Andrews, director of the Old Testament Company there, noted a particular afternoon as, quote, "our translation time," but added that most of our company are negligent, a statement that shows this company worked collectively rather than individually, as the Apocryphal Company seems to have done. So I'm going to try to build this out here. So January 1604 is when this thing is started. The king agrees to the translation in January 1604, okay? I'm going to say by, was it May or June on the previous? It was June, wasn't it? Yeah, the dated letter, so I'm going to change that to June. So by June 1604, the translators have started or have been chosen. And then we have reference to by August of that year, at least in some places, the translation was underway. But I think we could say clearly by 1605, everywhere in all three of the at Westminster, at Cambridge, and at Oxford, they had started working on the project at least by that date. Lively dies. What was the date on this here again? We just read it. Where did we read it at?
May 1605,
Edward Lively dies. So it's clear that by that point, so sometime between August 1604 and the beginning of 1605, the work is underway. And it may have been more advanced or less advanced depending on which company you're talking about and which one of the universities or locations you're talking about. So that's just something to bear in mind. So we can pretty much establish that. So if you look at the next point, Norton estimates that the Stage 1 company work took 3 to 4 years, commencing in 1604 and wrapping up in 1607 or 1608, depending on the company. So let's just draw that up here. So we're starting here, depending on the company, in either 1604 or 1605, all right? Stage 1 of the process, the company work, according to Norton, and we'll look at why he says this here in a minute. He says that this is wrapping up somewhere between either 1607 or 1608, depending on which company you're talking about. And he has reasons for why he's saying this. Anthony Wood is the author of The History of Antiquities of the University of Oxford. His account implies that the Oxford Old Testament Company's work was finished before the death of its head, John Reynolds, on the 21st of May, 1607. He says in his book, quote, "The said translators had recourse once a week to Dr. Reynolds at his lodgings in Corpus Christi College, and there, as it is said, perfected the work, notwithstanding the said doctor, who had the chief hand in it, was all the while sorely afflicted with the gout." So there's evidence to suggest that by May 1607, at least that stage was done. So that would be first stage revisions. Okay? That would be the first work of the company. Each company, as they're working, they're done sometime between 1607 and 1608. Likewise, a letter dated the 5th of December, 1608, from William Eyre from Emmanuel College, Cambridge, to James Usher, the Chancellor of St. Patrick Cathedral, Dublin, confirms that plans were being drawn up for a review of the whole work by the end of 1608. Dr. Norton suggests the following letter also implies that the Cambridge Old Testament Company's work had been completed for some time. Let's look at the quote here. Now, I can't do anything about these old quotes. Okay, they wrote how they wrote, and sometimes they're hard to follow, but if you focus, it's you can pretty much get what's going on. So again, this is a letter now that's dated the 5th of December, 1608. Here's what it says. "In my absence from Cambridge, there was an order taken from the King's Majesty by the Archbishop of Canterbury that the translation of the Bible shall be finished and printed so soon as may be." So that's the end of 1608. How many years has it been now? Four. The decision was made in January 1604. Now we have a dated letter from December 1608 that the king is starting to say, okay, guys, where are we at with this thing? Okay, so let's look at that sentence again. "In my absence from Cambridge, there was an order taken from the King's Majesty by the Archbishop of Canterbury that the translation of the Bible shall be finished and printed so as may be. 2 of every company are chosen to revise and confer the whole at London." So are they clearly talking about there what we have called the general meeting? Okay? So there's a dated letter from the end of 1608 talking about plans now for the general meeting, where 2 men of each company now are going to go to London to have this meeting. "Hereupon, I am earnestly requested to gain again that copy of our part which I lent you for D. Daniel to use, for albeit there are 2 fair written copies out of it, yet there will be use of it, because I noted in the margin," and this is a technical word, I don't really know what this word is, I've tried to find out and I haven't had much success, of the places which were doubted of. So think about what he's saying here. He says he noted in the margin of the places of doubt, and he's asking for this thing to be sent what? Back to him, right? Now, why would that be? He needs it back because they're organizing the general meeting, and are they going to need to discuss these places that they noted, that were doubted of? Or in other words, they weren't sure what the translation should be or how it should read in these places that were marked in this manuscript that he's talking about here. Okay, now we'll see more about what that could be in a little while. And this, Hebrew characters, i.e., it wants consideration, it is not in the others. So there are multiple copies. There are two out there that don't have these notations in them. There's a third one that has these notations in it. He's asking James Usher to send it back because they're preparing to have the general what?
Assembly.
The general assembly meeting. Okay? So let's just stop there. Is everybody clear about that? I know there's a lot of dates here, a lot of moving pieces, but hopefully you guys can follow what's going on.
It's actually 5 years, isn't it? Beginning of January 2004 to end of 2008.
Almost 5 years, I suppose, but calendar years. So we're building a process here. So by the end of 1608, do we have a documented letter talking about the king calling in the end of the work and the plans being made for the general meeting at London? Shake your head, yes, we do. December 5, 1608, we have a dated letter, all right? So that enables us now to get some handle now on where the process is at by the end of 1608. By the end of 1608, it appears that all of the companies have finished their work on revising their assigned sections, their allotted sections. Now, in the case of this group, it appears that they've been done for a while, because he's lent out a copy where there's notes in the margin that he's now asking for it what? Back. Okay? Any other questions at this point? Bart?
Were these translators a paid position, or were they just working after their jobs were over, or were they compensated for all these years?
It's a great question that I don't know the answer. In everything I've read, no one has ever talked about a salary, a stipend. I don't know the answer to that. Do you happen to know?
I don't remember where I read it or saw it, but I think they pretty much had to support themselves. And
that would sort of be my guess as well. I think for a lot of them, this was like their side gig. You know what I'm saying? Which is why it took, another reason why it possibly took so long. But I'm with Craig. I can't say for sure. Right. In fact, I would probably say probably not, but look at the next point. Ward Allen, author of Translating the New Testament Epistles, 1604 to 1611, a manuscript from King James Westminster Company, believes that as much as a year passed between the time the Cambridge Old Testament Company completed its work and Iyer's letter addressed to Usher in December 1608. So Ward Allen is the author of this book right here, Translating the New Testament Epistles. I only have this book in printed form. I have searched high and low on the internet to buy one, and I could not find one, and at least not for less than, like, say, $400, because it's out of print. And then I was looking on WorldCat, and I realized that there was one in the possession of The Ohio State University. So I called somebody that all of you know, and I said, listen, can you go to the university and obtain for me a copy of the book? This is the best I got, though, okay? So this is a scanned copy. I can make out most of it. Some of it's not so great, but this is an important book in what we're going to be discussing here, because what Ward Allen did is he went to the place that this manuscript was housed, and he spent 9 months to a year collating the whole thing. Okay, and I'll say more about that here in a little bit, but this is the source for what we're talking about. Ward Allen, author of Translating the New Testament Epistles, believes that as much as a year passed between the time the Cambridge Old Testament Company completed its work and Iyer's letter addressed to Usher in December 1608. So that letter from Iyer to Usher is the letter from the 5th of December 1608. Ward Allen believes that at least a year had happened since they finished their work and he wrote that letter. Okay? Now, I already told you, it has to be some amount of time,
because he loaned the copy out and he's now asking for it what? Back. Because there's things noted in it that they're going to need at the general meeting. All right, so let's look at the quote here. Because Iyer had noted with Hebrew characters questionable points in this part of the translation, his copy, it seems certain, came from the Old Testament company, which Lively had originated at Cambridge. The phrase, our part, must refer to work assigned to the whole company, since translators of each company worked on all of the books assigned to that company. Sometime before December 1608, the work of Lively's company had advanced to a state finished enough to warrant preparation of copies. When were the copies prepared? Time must be allowed for the preparation of Iyer's copy and the two fair copies out of it that he referenced in the letter we just read. For Iyer to have studied and marked it for the posting to Daniel, for Daniel to have studied, Iyer's copy was prepared then long before December 1608. If the copying and study took a full year, as well it might, Cambridge Company, like its sister company at Oxford, finished a stage of the work in 1607. So they're finished. They all start at the same point. I mean, they started within the roughly same 6 to 9 month time period, but some started earlier than others, etc. And they're not all finishing now at the same point, right? Some finish are probably finishing at some point in late 1607, but by late 1608, we have clear evidence that the king is calling the work in, and they're making arrangements now for the general meeting. William Iyer's dated letter, 5 December 1608, serves another important function as well, to confirm that the general meeting, which was to be of the chief persons of each company at the end of the work, Rule 10, began its work in 1609. Now think about it, right? So we have a dated letter from 1608, the last month of 1608, saying the king is anxious to have this thing called in, right? So we can say with pretty strong, that the general meeting now is going to start or commence probably in what year? 1609. All right? Is everybody following how we get to that point? Okay? Let's back to that. William Iyer letter dated, blah, blah, blah. Work began in 1609, was attended by a dozen of the translators. This is also confirmed in the report that Samuel Ward made to the Synod of Dort in 1618. As recorded by Alfred Pollard in the records of the English Bible, the documents related to the translation and publication of the English Bible, 1525 to 1611, quote, after each section had finished its work, 12 delegates chosen from all of them met together and reviewed and revised the whole work. Okay? Now, I do have a copy of that. I've actually got a copy of a lot of these things here that I pulled off the internet. Here's Pollard's records of the English Bible documents. This has the Iyer letter in it. It has a bunch of the stuff that I've referenced in these notes can be found in this book from 1911 that Pollard wrote with all the documents. Now, I would love to see this book updated to include all of the information that is now known about some of the primary source documents that we'll be talking about here shortly. Okay, but here's Pollard's work from that point. So look at the next point. So from the pieces we can put together, it seems that by 1609, the work of each individual company had been completed, at which time the general meeting commenced to look over the whole work, the work of each company and to finalize the text for printing. Before leaving a discussion of Iyer's letter, a few more scholarly comments and observations are in order regarding clues that can be derived from the letter as to how closely some of the other rules were followed. Ward Allen argues that all the procedural rules were followed and takes this to include rules 11 and 12. Okay, now, if you remember a couple weeks back, we were talking about to what extent the rules were followed, and we discussed how the rules ended up to be more like guidelines than what? Rules. Some were followed to varying degrees. Ward Allen is going to say that this Iyer letter shows, at least in some cases, that the rules were followed fairly closely. Here's what he says.
The evidence which has survived supports in detail the translator's faithfulness in following those instructions which outline the procedures of their work. He says on a few pages later, earlier, the 11th and 12th rules set forth the exact wording of the underlying section is unclear because of a poor copy. So that's me telling you that just a couple words there that I can't make out in my copy. King James directed the translators to seek the observations and judgments of learned men throughout the land. Iyer's copy was to this use. So think about this, okay? Iyer's talking in his letter from December, the 5th of December, 1608, how he has a copy and he sent it to who? Usher. Usher showed it to an unidentified guy named Daniel. Alright? Now he's asking for it back. So, that at least suggests to some degree, did they share their work with some other people outside of the companies? Alright? Look at the next point. Meanwhile, Professor Norton sees things a bit differently. He says, quote, other inferences than the ones made by Allen may be more probable. Rule 11 specifies that letters should be sent when any place of special obscurity is doubted of. Iyer's manuscript would only loosely fit this purpose, for it contains the whole work, and evidently the places so marked are to be the business of the general meaning. So what Norton is saying is, if Norton is disagreeing with Allen, he's disagreeing with Allen and he's saying, no, what the Iyer letter doesn't prove that they sent copies of this out to every learned man in the country. It's not proving that. He's disagreeing with what Ward Allen said. It would be stretching Rule 12 to think that it envision learning men reviewing drafts of the work. The most obvious sense is that the rule is a mechanism for obtaining comment on problems in the originals or in the extant English translations. Iyer's manuscript seems more appropriate to Rule 9, that individual books should be sent to the other companies for their comment, but still it does not fit exactly, because it contains the whole work. Now, the only known manuscript that appears to have been prepared for consultation, Lambeth Palace Manuscript 98, contains not one book, but most of the text of all the epistles, so the specification that, quote, any one book in Rule 9 may have to be treated loosely. Perhaps, therefore, Iyer's manuscript was prepared for the serious and judicial consideration of the other companies, following the spirit but not the letter of Rule 9. Presumably, two fair written copies of it were made for the same purpose, and it was expected that the copies would circulate in some way among the other five companies. Now, there's a lot of technical stuff there. Don't get lost in the weeds on that. What we have here are two different guys, Ward and Norton, disagreeing somewhat on what we can gather from looking at the Iyer letter from the 5th of December. I have to be honest with you, I tend to see it more the way Norton does. That this was not a mass circulation to all the learned men of England, but these things were prepared to be shared with amongst the different companies. Okay. Professor Norton goes on to explore other implications that can be derived from the Iyer letter. First, who was Iyer, seeing that he was not known to have been one of the translators? So he's not listed. Yet does he have knowledge of and is requesting a document that's going to be important for the general meeting? So we don't really know who he was. Was he an unnamed translator or secretary to one of the translators? We may never know. Second, why is he writing to James Usher in Dublin, Ireland? How does one of the documents related to the King James Bible end up in Ireland of all places? Dr. Norton offers the following possible explanations. Quote, Dr. Daniel must be William Daniel, Doctor of Divinity, translator of the New Testament and prayer book into Irish. So this guy translates into Irish. So, can you see where he might want to know what they're doing? Mm-hmm. If he's concerned about translating into Irish. He and Usher had coincided at Trinity College, Dublin, And in 1608, both held positions at St. Patrick's Cathedral, Daniel as treasurer, Usher as chancellor. Daniel had finished his New Testament and was working on his translation of the Book of Prayer. He presumably wanted to see the translator's work as an aid on this. So that guy's working on translating into what language? Irish. Can you see why he might want to know what they were doing with the King James Bible, all these this project back in England? Eyre, top page 5. Eyre then seems to have lent his manuscript as a scholarly courtesy. If he remembered the business of consulting with the other companies when he did this, he must have considered the two fair copies sufficient for the purpose. It's strange credibility to think that his manuscript was the company's master copy, therefore the master copy did not have the doubtful places marked. Nevertheless, when the king hastened the work, Eyre, or the Cambridge Company as a whole, realized that the only copy of their work with the doubtful places marked was in Ireland. And it was these queries that the general meeting needed to deal with particularly. They needed this information in addition to the master copy. If there is not a degree of carelessness in this whole situation, it seems that the king's order for the work to be, quote, finished and printed as soon as may be, caught the translators by surprise. They thought they had more time. Processes were cut short, and the envisioned envisioned consultations came to little. So we can stop right there. Everybody with me so far? So the bottom line is this: by 1609, are they having a general meeting? Some of the companies may have been done by 1607. By the end of 1608, the king is calling in the work, and the general meeting is going to commence sometime during 1609. Everybody with that?
Yeah.
Any questions?
These copies.
It's clear as mud, right? Go ahead.
Copies and manuscripts. And you got people from Ireland, and how do they know that they're even writing all this and doing all this? I mean, did that?
Oh, it was published throughout.
Okay.
Back here, when the decision is made,
yeah.
I mean, it's publicly made known that this is going to be happening, and it's taking, a while to get the gears moving on it. But by the time we get down here, when he's writing this letter, most of these companies have finished their work, the ones we talked about last week, and now they're going to go to the general meeting. So, there's one surviving manuscript from the first stage of the work, Lambeth Palace Manuscript 98. Now, I made a video about this on Thursday. Here's the Lambeth Palace Library website. They released 10 pictures of the manuscript online. This is the title page. That is on the Lambeth Palace Library website, the title page for Manuscript 98. This was prepared by the Second Westminster Company that worked on the New Testament epistles. So in this is Romans through Jude. Romans through Jude are in Manuscript 98, okay? So let's look at what it says here. There's one surviving manuscript from the first stage work, Lambeth Palace Manuscript 98. The manuscript was prepared by the Second Westminster Company that worked on the New Testament epistles, i.e., the Pauline and Jewish epistles, excluding Revelation. So Revelation's not in this. It's just Romans through Jude, okay? Access to the document was provided by Dr. Ward Allen in his 1977 publication, Translating the New Testament Epistles, 1604 to 1611, a manuscript from King James's Westminster Company. So again, that's this book right here. Okay? So the guy who wrote this book in 1977, he went to the library and he sat there with the actual manuscript on the table in front of him, and he used it to prepare this book. You following that? This is important that you follow what's going on, because this is going to factor big into future conversations. We will look at this document individually in a future lesson. For now, we will limit our comments on Manuscript 98 to the following summative comments by Dr. Norton. If the evidence of Manuscript 98 holds good for the work done by all the companies, the translation was half finished around the end of 1608. The king hurried the translators to the end of the work. The general meeting, which is to be of the chief persons of each company, Iyer's letter implies that this meeting was imminent. Okay? So according to what Norton is saying, by this point right here, they are how much done? The work in conforming the Bishop's Bible to the King James, what will become the King James Bible, is half done according to his scholarly estimation by the time we get to the beginning of the general meeting. And he's got documentary reasons why he is saying this. Okay? Discerning exactly what happened between 1609 and 1611 during the second half of the process is more difficult to discern. Professor Norton states the following regarding the matter, quote, "There are six pieces of evidence as to what happened in the next 2 to 3 years. Two of them are the most important evidence of all, the two 1611 printings of the King James. These, and the next most important, is the 1602 Bishop's Bible with annotations from the translators." Now, I'm just going to make a quick comment about that. Here is a picture, I think, if it will load, from the Bodleian Library in England of a document in their possession known as Bod 1602. Bod 1602 is a 1602 Bishop's Bible with the handwritten annotations of the translators in that Bible. Okay, so here you can see they scratched this word out, they wrote something else down here, they added something up here, they took this whole line out, and this is them transforming the Bishop's Bible into what? The King James Bible. There's the document right there. Okay, so any mystery that used to exist in this whole process, I'm not saying there isn't still some, because there is, but we can know way more now about what's going on with this process by looking at manuscript 98, which again was this manuscript right here. We can look at pages from it. Just do that quickly to show you. Here's a page. This is Romans chapter 1. So here we have Lambeth Palace Library. Here's the insignia of the library stamped in there. And it says the Epistle of St. Paul the Apostle to the Romans. And here is the first chapter of that. So we can look at the actual documents now. We can look at manuscript 98, which is indicative of the first stage of the project. We can look at the annotated Bishop's Bible in the possession of the Bodleian Library. Okay? Is everybody with me?
Yeah.
So go back to your notes. He says six. So there's six pieces of evidence that we can look at here. All right? Two 1611 printings of the King James. These and the next most important are the 1602 Bishop's Bible with annotations from the translators. This document right here that is pictured on the screen behind me. Though this involves some of the work done by the companies, it is also important evidence about the final form of the translator's work, and so it is best left on one side for the moment. So in other words, he wants you to know about it, but he's going to come back later and talk to you about it in more what? In more detail. One point needs noting from it immediately, though, and that it suggests that the finished work of the companies may have supplied up to 5/6 of the changes eventually made by the translators. So what does that mean? That means this document seems to supply up to 5/6 of the changes made by the translators. Is that a very high percentage?
Higher than half.
Yeah. Considerably more than the half suggested by manuscript 98. So what he's saying then is MS 98 represents what stage? The first stage. So by that point, how many of the changes are, if you can take this as a guide, he's saying that by the time you get to this point, it's how much done? It's half done, okay? And then enter now another document, what I'm calling Bod 1602, which is this Bishop's Bible, 1602 Bishop's Bible with the translators. This is evident. This is evident of far more revisions than what we even see in one document. 98. Manuscript 98, okay? So where am I at in this? Okay. One point needs noting further. We got that considerably. Okay. The remaining three pieces of evidence concern us at this point. They're the report noted above to the Synod of Dort. The Brief Life of John Boyce by Walker, and Boyce's Notes from the General Meeting. So Boyce's Notes from the General Meeting are given to us in this book right here, also by Ward Allen, translating for King James, and there is a picture of Boyce's notes. So Boyce is taking notes at the General Meeting. Okay. I should also add, this Ward Allen guy is an absolutely indispensable scholar in all of this, because he is the one that gives us access to all three primary documents, right? This one from 1969 covers the notes of John Boyce. This one from 1977 covers manuscript 98. And this one from 1995 covers Bob 1602. So he has gone to the locations, the pertinent locations in England, studied the manuscripts firsthand, and produced works to show us what is going on with these documents. Unfortunately, bottom of page 5, unfortunately, they are not entirely consistent with each other. So there's some differences there. And they do not provide answers to the two main problems. What was the nature of the final copy given to the printers, and what influence did the printers have on the text? Okay, now, those are important questions too. So what is he saying there? What is Norton saying? Okay, we don't know. So the General Meeting ends. They give something to the printer. No one knows for sure what was given to the printer. We don't know. The other thing we don't know from these six documents that he's listed out there is how the printers, what impact the printers might have had on the text. All right? Now, there's two guys from the process that are supposed to assist the printer. Miles Smith and Thomas Bilson are there, but we don't know what the final thing looked like that they actually gave to the printer, and we also don't know how the printer might have impacted the text. Okay? You following that? So how are we going to finish this or not? We'll be close. Please recall that Samuel Ward reported the following to the Synod of Dort in 1618. He says, quote, after each section had finished its task, 12 delegates were chosen from them all, met together and reviewed and revised the whole work. Lastly, the Reverend and Bishop of Winchester, Bilson, together with Dr. Smith, now Bishop of Gloucester, a distinguished man who had been deeply occupied in the whole work from the beginning, after all things had been maturely weighted and examined, put the finishing touches to this version. So, who are the two guys that are viewed as seeing it through to the press? It is Bilson and who? Miles Smith. Miles Smith is the guy who wrote the preface, the famous preface to the translator, the translators to the reader, the preface to the 1611. So, written with a first-hand quality, Ward's report suggests that there are two final stages that needed to be accounted for. One involving a dozen men and one involving two. In the interest of historical completeness and thoroughness, Norton compares the account of Ward at the Synod of Dort with Anthony Walker's Life of John Boyce. There is a discrepancy between the two accounts as to the number of men who were present at the General Meeting. Walker puts the number at 6, nearly half of Ward's number of 12. Norton offers two possible explanations for this discrepancy. First is that Walker's Life of John Boyce was written many years after the events and is therefore fuzzy on some of the details. A second is that each of the companies at the given universities sometimes acted as one unified company. Walker's mention of three Bibles, i.e., one from each location, Cambridge, Oxford, Westminster, lends some credibility to Norton's second option for reconciling these differences. Quote, another of Walker's details fits with this, that three copies of the Bible were sent to London, that is, one from each place. If this is true, the pairs of companies put their work together. This may have been a simple matter of binding together the sheets of their master copies of the bishop's Bible, which would have been enough to give each pair of the group a single identity. In short, Walker's understanding of what was meant by company may not be as wrong as it appears. So,
I debated whether or not I was going to even include that, but it seemed relevant, so I did.
So, there's two of the sources are unclear how many men are at the meeting. One seems to suggest how many?
12,
and another one seems to suggest what?
Six.
What Norton is giving there is a couple options for how to reconcile the difference between 12 and 6. How many companies were there?
Six.
So, how are we going to reconcile these? It's not clear. The notes of Boyce are consistent with the idea of 9 months' work taking place in 1610. Quote, the notes contain page references to a volume of Chrysostom that appeared in 1610, but not a volume that appeared in 1611. So what does that mean? That means in the notes, he references a volume of this guy's name that I can't say, and he's got a page number. The page number correlates with the edition of that was published in 1609, not a second edition that was published in 1610. That means that Boyce took the notes in what year?
Nine.
Okay. The notes contain page references that appear to a volume that appeared in 1610, but not the volume that appeared in 1611. Showing that the notes were made, I said that wrong, they're made in 1610, not 1611. And so lending credibility to the 9 months. This is, I think, beyond doubt. It raises a major question, what happened in 1609? The year that Iyer's letter suggests is when the general meeting convened. If the meeting was not as general as has been previously supposed, the answer could be this, that it did different parts of this work at different times and involved different people. Okay? So what's he saying there? It could be that the general meeting was not one meeting, but a series of what? Meetings. And they did this section, then this section, then this section, and then there were some different people present for each what? For each section. The idea has further attraction in that it would help us to account for the puzzling features of Boyce's notes. Boyce's notes are remarkably incomplete if the general meeting involved all who attended it in working through the entire text. In so doing, making at a minimum 1/6, but possibly as much as half of the textual changes that were still made. The notes cover discussion of the epistles and revelation only, forcing one to ask whether he was present only for this part on the work. Either he took no notes on the bulk of the work, or he was the only one involved with this part of it. So what is he saying here? Guys, if you look at Boyce's notes, his notes only cover Romans through Revelation. They don't cover any of the Old Testament. They don't cover any of the Gospels or the Book of Acts. They only cover Romans through Revelation. So what he's saying there is maybe they did have a series of smaller meetings and they worked on sections, right? And he's saying, why would Boyce, who takes copious notes of the part that he was there for, Romans through Revelation, not do so for the whole what? For the whole thing, if he were there for the whole thing. You following that? Yes?
No.
No? Shelby, did you say no?
I said yes.
Oh, okay. Because if you said no, then I'm like, I got to re-say all that. The second puzzling feature of Boyce's notes is that they do not account for all the work that had been done on the epistles and Revelation. Now, this is a fascinating point, okay? Manuscript 98 covers Romans through Jude. Boyce takes notes as they discuss that same one, that same section, minus Revelation. So can we see now the first stage through manuscript 98 and the last stage through the notes of voice? So can we make very good can we make very good observations now because we have this manuscript, manuscript 98 from the company that did Romans through Jude, and now we have Boyce's notes also that covers essentially that entire section with the addition of what? Revelation at the end. Okay? So, the second puzzling feature of Boyce's notes is that they do not account for all the work that had been done on the epistles and Revelation. Much more work happened between the preparation of manuscript 98 and the print of the text than, than his notes account for, I think it should say that. Now check this out. 2,974 changes were made independently of the preparation of manuscript 98. But Boyce records just under 500 items for discussion, the majority of which concern the original rather than the particulars of the English translation. Even if each of these items of discussion led to a change in the text, which did not happen, they would account for less than a twelfth of the changes. It may be that he did not record all of the discussion he was present at, but somewhere there is significantly more work to be what? Accounted for. Now, where do you think we're going to look for that work? You're going to look for it here. Bod 1602. The annotated edition of the 1602 Bishop's Bible in the possession of the Bodleian Library bridges the gap between manuscript 98 and the notes of voice. We will discuss this document in detail in future lessons. In a future lesson, we will look at the first printed editions of the King James Bible from 1611. The purpose of this lesson was to establish a work-in-progress timeline to capture the full scope of the translation process utilized by the various companies in transforming the 1602 Bishop's Bible into the 1611 King James. Please consider the following summary of the information from the pen of Dr. David Norton presented in this lesson. He says, quote, "Given the incompleteness of the evidence and the puzzles it contains, the best solution is to recognize that while we now have more evidence than previous historians, just how the translators worked remains mysterious. We have illuminating glimpses of a complex process, but critical pieces of the puzzle are still missing. Until now, historians of the making of the King James Bible have to interpret the available evidence as showing, as showing an orderly collective process such as went into the making of the Revised Version." Now let me just stop there. Everything that I have ever read and all the teaching I have ever heard is presented in sort of this, they did this, they did this, done. Like everything just went off like without a what?
Hitch,
and it was all smooth, and everything just happened the way it was supposed to. Various hints and glimpses in the evidence, it seems to me, tend towards a more muddled picture, wherein the KJV stands partway between the orderly committee work of the Revised Version and the individualism of the Bishop's Bible. Small groups and perhaps individual work contributed to the final project, and the rules of the work from which an ordered picture is easily inferred, what I just said a minute ago, were not as literally and uniformly followed as has been imagined. And it is time to put best guesses on available evidence and possibilities. Six companies produced draft translations between 1604 and 1608. They sometimes subdivided their work, and they went over it twice. Manuscript 98 represents first draft work. At this stage, about half the eventual readings had been settled. Bod 1602's New Testament annotations represent work as it left the hands of the companies. Flag that. That doesn't seem right to me. That should say which places. 5/6 of the readings were settled. I need to check that sentence, Sylvia. The work was called in 1608, and the companies forwarded it to the general meeting in the form of annotations to the bishop's Bible text. The general meeting had working copies made of some of the submitted work. It worked over these in small groups in 1609 and 1610. Two men worked over the whole text in cooperation with the printer, establishing the King James as its first as first printed in 1611. Whatever manuscripts there might have been, this, with the second print, effectively became the master copy of the King James Version. So I think we can see here that it's certainly not as neat and tidy, okay? Thing gets rolling off, the decision to translate is made in January 1604. By the late June 1604, they're organized. By August 1604, we have evidence that some of the translational companies have started to meet. The first stage is done between 1607 and 1608, depending on which company we're talking about. A dated letter of the 5th of December, 1608, suggests that the general meeting is going to happen in the next year, and the general meeting seems to have transpired over 1609 and 1610, and the thing is finally printed and published when? In 1611. We have three surviving primary work-in-progress documents that are known to history. There may be others, we just don't know of them. Number one is the Notes of Boyce, which would have been the final stage of the discussion that occurred on Romans through Revelation. The middle one is Bod 1602, with the annotations made by the translators into the Bishop's Bible. And the first one is Manuscript 98, which was produced by the Second Westminster Company, covering Romans through Jude. Way more is known now than was known even, I'm going to say, 10 years ago, even, well, for sure 20 years ago. Okay? So, we're basically right on the number here, but does anybody have any comments or questions?
What about proofreading after? Because I worked in the printing industry for a long time, and where I used to work, you know, we had paid proofreaders. And that was their job, is to proofread stuff. And then later on, we only relied on what the customer sent us. And a lot of times, you know, we would print stuff. And I go,
so
obviously nobody proofread this. So
we're going to do a whole lesson on the first edition and look at how that's set up. So imagine an early 17th century print shop. You had all the characters. You had literally the uppercase, the lowercase. Each page had to be laid out individually and typeset. So there's somebody called a compositor, then there's somebody that's checking his work, and even with all that, they still made clear printing errors, and all sorts of things happened, even with all that happening, and two translators there that are seeing it through. Okay? And it could be the case, I'm just going to say it that way for now, that the printer exerts somewhat of his own influence over some things here and there. Okay? But we're not ready to talk about that yet. That's coming down the line. Yeah.
I've got a little memory of the printing that we used to do in junior high, where we had a printing press that you actually set the type and everything. In a Bible situation where it's a continually reprinted copy, because it's so popular, did they keep those the type set aside as a ready to go again in the future?
So,
or did they?
I can only give you a partial answer.
Yeah.
The issue with that would be cost.
Yeah.
The immense cost of having standing trays full of text,
right,
and where are you going to put it? For every page of the Bible, okay?
And how long they printed without...
An early American printer in 1792 named Hugh Gain, he built a warehouse, and he did keep standing trays of type for every page.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense.
In 1803, a guy named Matthew Carey bought from Hugh Gain all of his standing type and started printing his own. So I know it did happen later on. I don't think it happened here. So the next time they want to print it, what do they have to do?
Redo it.
do the whole thing. And that's why new typos and new printer errors now are going to show up in the next edition. Why? Because they reset everything. If they were using the same standing type, they would have had the same one. Largely the same, whatever the printer errors were in the first, they would have showed up again in the second. But now in the second, they correct some of the printer errors of the first, but now they got new ones. And the reason they got new ones is because they probably reset the whole thing again. I mean, that would just drive me crazy. I can't even imagine that for every page of the whole Bible.
I don't know.
I mean, the time and the money and the expense for that, it's just, it's crazy to think about.
Well, I do have to pay the newspaper for that.
So, anything else on this? We do need to quit, yeah.
I don't want to put you off on a rabbit trail or anything, but on page 3 where that you have that technical word,
yep.
It's possible that, and I know there's a rabbi, Rashi, I know there's some inconsistency with spelling and stuff like that, but it could be that it was in a margin by a copy of this rabbi, Rashi, that had the Hebrew, because it talks about the Hebrew there.
Yeah.
Hebrew notes.
I think you could be possibly right about that, but I don't have anything to go on right now to even run that rabbit trail, but you could be right. Okay, thanks for, now, hang on a minute before you go. Next Sunday, we will have class this hour, but it will not be on this. I know Mike and Sylvia are going to be busy. They're not going to be around. I think others of folks have commitments and stuff for Christmas or whatever. We will have class. It'll either be Bud doing something or I'm going to do something. It's not going to be lesson 162. Then the following Sunday, Bud is going to teach a lesson the first Sunday of the new year. And then after that, we'll resume this with 162. Okay? All right. Thanks for your attention.